Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Last week, there was yet another police killing of an unarmed black citizen in central Ohio, this time in Blendon Township. Takiyah Young, a young mother of two who was 8 months pregnant, was suspected by a store employee of shoplifting some beer from a Kroger store on Sunbury Road. She had left the store and gotten into her car with her groceries when several Blendon Township police officers approached her car, shouting for her to exit the vehicle. Their aggressive manner and the fact that at least one of them had drawn a gun appeared to frighten Takiyah, who refused to leave the safety of her vehicle. She denied having stolen anything. The officer who had drawn his gun stepped in front of the car and pointed the gun directly at Takiyah through the windshield. It's unclear whether Takiyah deliberately advanced the vehicle toward the officer in front of her, but as the vehicle began to creep forward, the officer fired a single shot, fatally wounding Takiyah. Over the weekend, there were several protests in Columbus, which I would have attended if I had been in town or if they had been publicized in advance. I would have had audio from any one of those protests if anyone had gathered and published it on social media or on a website. What I do have are a couple of news reports from local commercial outlets and a podcast segment that analyzes the details. This week, yet another military aid package for Ukraine was announced as the U.S. prepares to send yet another $1 billion in a package that includes depleted uranium shells for use in the U.S.-manufactured Abrams tanks that have already been supplied but are not yet in use in the fight against the Russian invasion. We spent a great deal of hours on this show questioning the popular narrative portraying the Ukraine conflict as a fight of good against evil, right against wrong, valiant, benevolent, democratic West against dark, menacing, totalitarian East, and that is indeed the prevailing rationale behind the massive U.S. military aid strategy in lieu of any attempts to seek a negotiated settlement. There are some who might want to minimize the brutality of the Russian campaign, but I think we have enough corroborating accounts from credible sources from across the spectrum to surmise that the level of criminality in the Russian conduct is very real. But it may also be the case that the Ukrainian military is guilty of a few atrocities of its own, such as bombing civilian populations in Crimea or Donetsk. My point has always been that although the Ukrainian cause of self-defense is clearly valid, there aren't exactly any heroes in this equation, including the United States, which has seemingly sought to prolong the war for its own gains rather than to try to bring the war to a close via some means other than direct military engagement. The legacy of this war is already being felt around the globe, most especially in Africa, where resource-deprived countries depended on grain from Ukraine are facing near-famine conditions. And when the conflict resolves, however, what the U.S. and other Western allies are doing now, flooding Ukraine with weapons and now with depleted uranium, will assure that the war's impact will be suffered by Ukrainians long after the last bullet flies or even after the last surviving combatant has expired. That is because depleted uranium has severe public health impacts for generations after it's been deployed. We have a detailed report on the effects of depleted uranium that was used by the U.S. in Iraq in its war against Iraq. But first, the case of Takiyah Young. Here's some local reports.
Now, breaking news from NBC4.
That breaking news, we are getting our first look at what led to a deadly shooting involving a Blendon Township police officer and a pregnant woman. We do want to thank you for tuning in at midday. I'm Jennifer Bullock. Now, we are going to walk you through this video, but also recognize not everyone wants to see this. So we do want to warn you, some of these images will be disturbing. Now is the time to either mute the television or leave the room. Today's body camera release comes 8 days after Takiyah Young was shot in the Kroger parking lot on Sunbury Road. It was August 4th. Blendon Township's police chief John Belford says the 21-year-old was one of several people stealing alcohol. When police were alerted, officers say Young was in her vehicle and was asked several times to get out. Police then say Young put the car in gear and drove toward an officer. Chief Belford says Young was given aid on the scene, but later died from her injuries. Once again, we are going to show you that body camera video from the police officers from that evening. We are bringing you team coverage of the release. NBC4's Caleb Michael standing by with reaction from Young's family. But we begin with Jamie Ostroff here to walk us through the newly released video. Again, warning you ahead of time that what we are about to show you is disturbing in case you would like to step away. Jamie.
Yeah, Jen, thank you. So what we are about to see is body-worn camera footage from each of the two officers who were involved in this incident last Thursday. Each video is just over a minute long as the confrontation with Takiya Young plays out in just a matter of seconds.
The first officer to interact with Takiya Young approaches her car under the suspicion that she stole liquor from Kroger.
Hey, stop. Hey, out of the car. Out of the car.
By the time the second officer gets to the car and walks in front of it, the first officer had asked Young to get out five times. He keeps asking. Young argues. As the officer continues asking Young to get out of the car, she begins to drive. The officer in front of the car fires one shot through the windshield. We have paused the video to not show that deadly shot. When we pick up the video a moment later, you hear the commands continue. The car rolls through the parking lot, stopping under the awning by the store. The video ends with officers busting the driver's side window to get Young out of the car.
Now, while Young argues with one of the officers, she denies stealing anything from Kroger, and she can be heard saying, "Are you going to shoot me?" Also, you may have noticed Blendon Township Police did not identify either of the officers and even blurred their faces there in the video. Chief John Belford alluded to Marcy's Law, claiming the two officers are crime victims and believes their identities are protected by state law. Jen.
All right, Jamie, thank you. Right now, NBC4's Caleb Michael is live outside the Blendon Township Police Department, which is where Takiya Young's family viewed the video for the first time earlier this morning. Caleb, you spoke with the family's attorney. What can you tell us?
Well, Jen, we were here when Takiya Young's family arrived to go inside the Blendon Township Police Department and view that body cam video. They were inside for less than 10 minutes. When they came back outside, it was silent. They were visibly upset, crying. They gave each other hugs. They got in their cars, and then they drove away. Now, shortly after that is when the Blendon Township Police Department publicly released that video with a statement, detailing the process they went through to get to this point and why it took them more than a week. Chief John Belford says this situation is a tragedy and is asking for prayers to the family during this time. Shonda Brown, the attorney representing the family, says they were not ready to speak on camera, but she did tell us this.
Family is obviously distraught. They've just seen the video of their daughter, of their granddaughter, of their mother for her young children, what we believe get killed by the police department. And I think the video is going to speak for itself. And I think you guys are going to be able to see it. And we appreciate the concern that the community has for the family. And it's just going to be, a devastating video for people to see.
Jen, we also learned that the officer who did not fire their weapon is back on active duty, but that officer who did fire their weapon is still on leave pending a review. Local for you in Blendon Township, I'm Caleb Michael, NBC4.
Caleb, thank you. Now, along with the video, Blendon Township Police Chief John Belford released a written statement. He addresses why it took 8 days for the public to be able to see what happened. Belford's statement says in part, quote, "We did not provide a precise estimate of a particular release date to anyone, as we were unsure of how long it would take to make the countless redactions and undergo the required legal review." He goes on to say a lawsuit is very likely to be filed about this incident. There may be other legal proceedings as well. That's why we are very limited in what we can say. We are being as transparent and forthcoming as we can, given the significant legal constraints. As a result, we don't anticipate making any further statements until official actions are taken. Right now, the Fraternal Order of Police is holding a press conference on the release of that video. We have a crew there and we'll bring you their reaction coming up. And of course, our team is continuing to go through the video and we'll bring you any updates throughout the newscast as well as online at NBC4i.com.
A police officer responding to an alleged shoplifting outside of a Kroger grocery store in Blinden Township, Ohio, took the life of 21-year-old Takiya Young and her unborn child. According to the Associated Press, Ohio authorities released body cam video showing a police officer fatally shooting Takiya Young in her car in what her family denounced as a gross misuse of power and authority against the pregnant black mother. Now, we're going to get to that video in a moment, but first we're going to get through this article because this article is going to pose some issues that we're going to address after we see the video. So let's get through this, and then we'll have a look at that video. Sean Walton, an attorney representing Young's family, said the video clearly shows that the August 24th shooting of the 21-year-old woman was unjustified, and he called for the officer to be fired and charged immediately. Walton also criticized police for not releasing the video footage for more than a week after the shooting. Takiya's family is heartbroken, Walton said in an interview with the Associated Press. The video did nothing but confirm their fears that Takiya was murdered unjustifiably. And it was just heartbreaking for them to see Takiya having her life taken away under such ridiculous circumstances. Young's death follows a troubling series of fatal shootings of black adults and children by Ohio police and numerous occurrences of police brutality against black people across the nation in recent years, events that have prompted widespread protests and demands for police reform. The officer who shot Young is on paid administrative leave while the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation examines the shooting, which is standard practice. A police union official said calls to charge the officer before an investigation is complete are premature. A second officer who was on the scene has returned to active duty. Their names, races, and ranks have not been released. Blinden Township Police Chief John Belford called the shooting a tragedy. Miss Young's family is understandably very upset and grieving, he said in a written statement released Friday morning. While none of us can fully understand the depths of their pain, all of us can remember them in our prayers and give them the time and space to deal with this heartbreaking turn of events. Young's father, grandmother, and other relatives watched the video before its public release and released a statement Friday through Walton. It is undeniable that Takiya's death was not only avoidable, but also a gross misuse of power and authority, the statement said. While viewing the video, the family felt a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, Walton told the AP. More than anything, there was a sense of just devastation. To know that this power system, these police officers, could stop her and so quickly take her life for no justifiable reason. The video shows an officer at the driver's side window telling Young she has been accused of theft and repeatedly demanding that she get out of the car. A second officer is standing in front of the car. Young protests, and the first officer repeats his demand. Then both officers yell at her to get out. At that point, Young can be heard asking them, "Are you going to shoot me?" Seconds before she turns the steering wheel to the right, and the car moves toward the officer standing in front of it. The officer fires his gun through the windshield, and Young's sedan drifts into the grocery store brick wall. Officers then break the driver's side window, which Belford said was to get Young out of the car and render medical aid, though footage of medical assistance was not provided. In his interview with the AP on Friday, Walton denied that Young had stolen anything from the grocery store. He said his firm found a witness who saw Young put down bottles of alcohol as she left the store. The bottles were left in the store, he said. So when she's in her car denying that, that's accurate. She did not commit any theft. And so these officers were not even within their right to place her under arrest, let alone take her life. Brian Steele, executive vice president of the union representing Blinden Township Police, criticized Walton's characterization of the shooting as murder before all the facts are in. He said an investigation will determine whether the shooting was justified. The fact is, the officer had to make a split-second decision while in front of a moving vehicle, a 2,000-pound weapon, he said. But Edward Obayashi, a national use of force expert, an attorney who specializes in vehicle-related police shootings, said that while the officer who shot Young may have reasonably feared for his safety, it went against all his law enforcement training to be in front of her car in the first place. The best practice in these matters nationwide is that you do not put yourself in a position of danger, said Obayashi, especially given that it was a minor crime Young was being accused of. The results are predictable. Based on your training, why are you going to put yourself in front of a vehicle, in front of an individual that does not want to cooperate, Obayashi said. There was no urgent need for him to position himself the way he did. The Blendon Township Police Department's use of force policy states that officers should try to move away from an approaching vehicle instead of firing their weapons. An officer should only shoot when he or she reasonably believes there are no other reasonable means available to avert the imminent threat of the vehicle, or if deadly force other than the vehicle is directed at the officer or others. The article goes on to say that Young was expected to give birth to a daughter in November. Family and friends held a private vigil a day after Young was killed, releasing balloons and lighting candles spelling out R.I.P. Kaya. An online effort to pay her funeral expenses has raised over $7,000. Before we look at the video, I just want to go back to the Blendon Township Police Department's use of force policy and remind you what that says. It says, an officer should only shoot when he or she reasonably believes there are no other reasonable means available to avert the imminent threat of the vehicle, or if deadly force other than the vehicle is directed at the officer or others. So in order to use deadly force in this situation, the officer has to reasonably believe that there is no other reasonable means to avert the imminent threat of the vehicle. I also want you to couple that with the expert's opinion that it was unreasonable for the officer to place himself in front of the moving vehicle in the first place. That, we'll have a look at the video. I'll let you come to your own conclusions.
Out of the car. 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 They said, you're still stuffed, do not leave. Get out of the car. Then get out. Out of the car. Get out of the car. Then get out. Go. Get out.
Get out of the car.
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 Kia and her unborn child are now dead. And an officer moved in front of her vehicle. And as she was traveling what looked to be 7-8 miles an hour, he apparently felt that it was unreasonable for him to take evasive action to avoid being hit by the car, and that justified him shooting around into the windshield. My name is Nathan Saunders, and this is The Legal Good.
This family deserves to have America's justice system work for them. This family deserves to know that when someone does wrong, when someone does when someone commits an act this heinous, that they will be protected. Before Connor Grubb fired that weapon, he said, get the fuck out the car. That's what he said. And then as that car slowly rolled away after they shot her, they continued to curse at her and say, stop the car, and curse at her. The intent there is just so ugly.
I believe he was a bully. and he came at her like a bully, and that scared her with that baby in her stomach. She's like scared. Just a man walking up to her, cussing at her, and she don't not really knowing why.
Fully expect criminal charges to be brought against this officer. We fully expect this officer to be terminated. If those things do not happen, it is a matter of public safety. And I trust those who have been who have taken an oath to protect and serve our communities to do just that and to protect us. So I fully believe that it's going to happen.
I'll try to follow that story to the best of my ability as it unfolds. We have next a very detailed and meticulous study of the effects of depleted uranium that was used by the U.S. in its war on Iraq, presented by Canadian graduate researcher Shelby Sertig. It includes a detailed explanation of what depleted uranium is, why it's used, and the dangers it presents. I've edited the presentation for time and to remove some of the beginning introductions.
The Juno World Affairs Council presents Depleted Uranium in Iraq, a summary of public health impacts and controversy, with Shelby Sertig. Sertig studied the topic while living in Beirut, Lebanon, for her master's thesis in environmental health. Sertig grew up in Skagway and has been active around nuclear issues since high school.
Is it a boy or a girl? Usually, this is the first question that a mother asks after giving birth. But according to doctors from the Ibn Ghazan Obstetrics Hospital in Basra, Iraq, this is no longer the case. Instead, mothers ask, is it normal? Beginning in the mid-1990s, medical doctors in southern Iraq began observing unusually high rates of congenital birth defects in areas of Iraq that had been heavily bombarded during the first Gulf War. And those doctors suspected that the cause of the birth defects was exposure to a toxic, radioactive heavy metal that is used in some bullets, tanks, and tank penetrators by the U.S. military called depleted uranium. And what I'll present today is actually a piece of the findings from my master's thesis research, which was titled A Systematic Review of the Associations Between Exposure to Weaponized Uranium and Adverse Health Outcomes Among the Iraqi Population. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. conducted 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands. And during that time period, the U.S. military carried out a human radiation experiment called Project 4.1, during which they purposely exposed Marshallese people to fallout from Castle Bravo, which was the largest atmospheric nuclear test that the U.S. ever conducted. And I'm sorry that this photo is so grainy, but what you're looking at is the image of a Marshallese woman holding a sign with her assigned subject test number. It says wrong. Number 39, wrong, standing for Rongelap, and it shows severe radiation burns on her face and neck. While we were there, we had the opportunity to meet with a woman named Lijon Eknalong. And Lijon was 6 years old, the year that Castle Bravo, the nuclear test, was conducted. And she was one of the subjects that was recruited without her consent into Project 4.1. So she was treated essentially as a human guinea pig. 1 year after Erica and I visited the Marshall Islands, Lijon came to Juneau, and she spoke at the World Nuclear Awareness Conference that was organized at UAS in 2008. And while she was at UAS, Lijon spoke about the impacts that exposure to radiation had had on her body and how she was never able to have children of her own. She talked about how 7 times she gave birth to babies without limbs, without bones, with translucent skin, babies that were born dead or didn't survive. In the Marshall Islands, These are called jellyfish babies or bomb babies. We decided to Google jellyfish baby because we wanted to see and we wanted to comprehend what women in the Marshall Islands were experiencing. So, you know, we typed into our computer, jellyfish baby, and the images that emerged on our screen, the sad, horrible images, were not from the Marshall Islands. They were from Iraq. And that was the moment that I became aware of depleted uranium. So fast forward, as an undergraduate at UAF, I remained interested in nuclear issues. I volunteered at UAF's gamma ray spectroscopy lab, which after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident in 2011, tested marine mammal tissues from Alaska for Fukushima-derived radionuclides. And I got to help with that, and it was an extremely meaningful and rewarding period of my life. As an undergraduate, I was also interested in political science, and I studied Arabic. And one summer, I won a scholarship to study Arabic in Tunisia. And after that, I decided that I wanted to study or go to graduate school in an Arabic-speaking country and continue to do nuclear stuff. And then in 2016, I won a scholarship to study environmental health at the American University of Beirut in Beirut, Lebanon. Our central research question was, is environmental exposure to weaponized uranium associated with adverse patient-important health outcomes among the Iraqi population? And now I'll explain how we tried to answer that question. Following this standard scientific format. In the background, I'll talk about the properties of depleted uranium as well as its mechanism of toxicity. And in the methods, I'll tell you more about what a systematic review is and why we chose that as our method to answer our research question. As you probably know, uranium is a naturally occurring radioactive heavy metal. It has an atomic number of 92, so 92 protons, and it has an atomic weight of 238, which tells you that it has a really big nucleus. And the forces that hold nuclei together are weak. So uranium nuclei have a tendency to break apart in a process called decay. That process releases energy, and that energy is radioactivity. We normally talk about three types of radioactive energy: gamma rays, beta rays, and alpha radiation. Uranium typically emits alpha radiation when it decays. And that is the most powerful form of radiation, but it's also the least penetrating. It can't travel very far in the air, so in order to cause biological damage, it has to be internalized. In nature, uranium exists in three isotopic forms. And 238, which is the longest-lived isotope, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which means that it's very unlikely to decay. But when it does decay, it goes through 17 progeny, including the isotope 234, the uranium isotope 234. Isotopes 235 and 234 are less abundant, but they have shorter half-lives and higher specific activities, so they contribute more overall to the radioactivity of natural uranium. So you can see here, 234 makes up only 0.005% of all natural uranium, but it emits almost 50% of the radioactivity. Of these three isotopes, only 235 is fissionable, meaning that in order to manufacture fuel for nuclear weapons or nuclear energy fuel, the concentration of 235 isotopes has to be increased. That process is called enrichment, and it produces a waste product that has less 235, fewer 235 isotopes. So it's depleted of 235. And that's what we call depleted uranium. or DU. Depleted uranium is 40% less radioactive than natural uranium because it has fewer of the isotopes 235 and 234. It's also one of the heaviest and densest materials known to man. And in its metallic form, it's not just radioactive. It's also highly reactive, chemically reactive. In fact, it's pyrophoric. And that means that when exposed to air, the metal will spontaneously combust, forming uranium oxide aerosols. For all of those reasons, as well as its abundance and its low price, the US military began experimenting with depleted uranium in conventional weapons in the 1970s and used them in combat for the first time in Iraq during the first Gulf War. The first Gulf War began on August 2, 1990, when the Iraqi military invaded Kuwait. In response, an international military coalition was created, led by the US. Over the short 5-month war, more than 90,000 tons of bombs were dropped on Iraq, and that devastated Iraq's infrastructure, including its highways, hospitals, water treatment facilities, sewage treatment facilities. The international response also included the imposition of economic sanctions by the United Nations Security Council. These were the most comprehensive and the harshest economic sanctions that have been imposed by the Security Council on any country. And they remained in place long after the first Gulf War. Some of the sanctions weren't lifted until 2010. The sanctions, combined with the destruction of Iraq's infrastructure, devastated Iraq's public health. And among all of the bullets that were fired and all of the bombs that were dropped on Iraq during the first Gulf War, some contained depleted uranium. The U.S. reports that at least 350 tons of depleted uranium were used in Iraq between 1990 and 1991. And during that time, DU was used only in southern Iraq, in the governorate of Basra and near the borders of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. During the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. and coalition forces again used depleted uranium munitions. But in this case, the U.S. hasn't reported a figure concerning the total amount of DU that's been used. But some DU firing coordinates have been obtained by George Washington University and by the Dutch peace organization PAX because they filed a Freedom of Information Act request. So what these DU firing coordinates show is that DU has now been used across Iraq, not just in the southern governorate, but in almost every governorate in the country. The International Atomic Energy Agency estimates that as much as 1,700 metric tons of depleted uranium could have been used in Iraq since 2003. That's a lot of DU. But DU is definitely not the only toxic remnant of war that people in Iraq could be exposed to. And it's not the only factor that could contribute to adverse public health outcomes during or after conflict. So what is so concerning about DU specifically? What's specifically concerning about its toxicity? And how could exposure to weaponized uranium lead to adverse health impacts decades after the weaponized uranium has been used? Well, I'll tell you. When depleted uranium munitions hit a hard target, like an armored tank, they create uranium oxide aerosols, which can remain suspended in air, or they can be dispersed in the wind. They can settle on the ground or be resuspended by the wind. And eventually, they get inhaled. And that's where the uranium becomes internalized. Once uranium enters the lungs, it can be absorbed into the bloodstream in the alveolar region of the lungs, either via diffusion or phagocytosis. Also, some uranium oxides are water soluble. So when they settle on the ground, they can be dissolved in water, enter watersheds, and then enter the body via ingestion. After being internalized into the bloodstream, uranium oxides are metabolized to uranyl ions, which can readily bond with other molecules like proteins and then be circulated through the body via systemic circulation. Most of the uranium that is absorbed into the bloodstream is excreted in urine within 24 hours. But the small amount that remains, about 10%, is stored in the bones, in the kidneys, and in the liver. It's also capable of crossing the blood-brain barrier and the placental barrier. Animal experiments and laboratory petri dish studies have shown that uranium is capable of all sorts of terrible things at the cellular level. Animal experiments have also shown that exposure to uranium can induce carcinogenic and teratogenic effects. So for those reasons, internalized uranium, whether enriched, natural, or depleted, is classified by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, as a Group 1 carcinogen. So that's a general summary of the properties of depleted uranium and its toxicity. And given that well-documented toxicity, when doctors in Iraq began seeing increasing rates of birth defects in places that had been subject to heavy military bombardment, when they started seeing birth defects and cancer, they had a strong suspicion that depleted uranium was the cause. But in public health, suspicion is not enough. It's not enough to influence policymakers. It's not enough to fund medical interventions, and it's often not enough to persuade other academics. And so for two decades, research was conducted, and media and the academic literature raged with debate and controversy over this topic. And one of the most controversial events in this debate occurred in 2013 when the Iraqi Ministry of Health published a summary report of a national household congenital birth defect study that they'd conducted in 2011 with funding and support from the World Health Organization. The study found that Iraq had not experienced any increase in birth defects since the first Gulf War, and it denied finding any link between DU exposure and birth defects. Well, the academic literature responded and harshly criticized that study. They said it hadn't undergone peer review, its methods were questionable, and the World Health Organization was accused by a major cover-up, including by former administrators in the United Nations. So there was this big controversy, there was lots of debate, the media was really hyped, and then silence. The IMOH never published a full report from that study, and the data was never made available to independent researchers for analysis or verification. And then public attention on the issue faded. And that's kind of the trend with DU research. There's these waves of attention and controversy and then silence and then more research. And when I started this research project, I thought, surely enough research has been conducted. Like, surely enough data and evidence exists to show that there is an association between DU exposure and adverse health outcomes, including birth defects and cancer in southern Iraq. I was certain. I just thought maybe some of the research has been covered up. Maybe it hasn't been synthesized. Maybe Iraqi researchers are only publishing in Arabic in Iraqi journals, and so their findings aren't available to a wider scientific audience. So I sat down with my advisor and I told her all of this, and she said, "Shelby, you have to do a systematic review." And I was like, "Systematic review? What's that?" Well, a systematic review is, it's a literature review. It's a fancy literature review. But it's very big, and it's very meticulous, and it's very specific. And it is secondary data analysis. And in clinical medicine, systematic reviews are considered the highest tier of evidence. And that's because they have a rigorous, transparent methodology. They have transparent, reproducible search strategies. They have pre-specified, pre-published screening protocols that buffer the review against bias. And they engage a team of reviewers and researchers who conduct screening independently so that they can act as quality check and quality assurance against each other. But before we could conduct a systematic review on this topic, we needed to be absolutely certain that no one else had ever conducted a systematic review on this topic before. So we contacted a medical librarian, and she helped us check. And when we were doing that check, we learned that over 30 review articles, so articles summarizing primary research, 30 review articles had been published on this topic since 2003. But only one of those reviews had been conducted systematically, and it only looked at the impact of depleted uranium on U.S. Gulf War veterans, not on the Iraqi civilian population. In fact, almost all of these review articles focused on Gulf War veterans, not Iraqi people. So we realized that this kind of study hadn't been conducted before. There was a gap in the literature, and we launched a project to try and fill that gap. I will say briefly that using a systematic review method, our goal was to capture the overlap of every study ever published on uranium and every study ever published on Iraq. So we were trying to find that overlap and then screen the articles to get our final set of included studies that met our inclusion criteria. We implemented our search strategy in 11 databases. We captured 3,105 records. So those are articles, studies. We screened them, and after the screening process, we were left with 26 articles, but some of those articles reported the results of multiple studies. So there could be an article that publishes results from a study in Fallujah and a study in Basra, and they're published in the same article. And so we had a final set of 31 studies, which was more than any other review paper on this topic had identified before. We found way more studies than we expected, actually. We were kind of thinking, like, maybe we'd find 10, and 31 was huge. This map shows the geographic scope of our included studies. So you can see pretty well distributed across Iraq. Their publication dates ranged from 1999 to 2017. And there were 6 health outcome categories that these studies focused on. They were congenital birth defects, cancer, other birth outcomes like infant mortality, immune system function, BCL2 oncogene expression, and mixed outcomes. And this is not very systematic of me, but I'm just going to highlight the findings from 2 of those health outcome categories, birth defects and cancer. Okay, so 10 of our included studies looked at congenital birth defects as their health outcome of interest. And of those, 4 specifically looked at birth defect incidence. So they were looking at changes in the rate of birth defects among a population in a given region before and after the region had been contaminated with depleted uranium. And all four of those studies found higher rates of birth defects after contamination. And one of those studies found that between 1994 and 2003, the rate of birth defects in Basra had increased by 17 times. The other six birth defect studies were studies that directly measured uranium concentration in human biological samples that were collected from parents who had given birth to babies with birth defects and healthy controls. And then they compared the mean uranium concentrations between those two cases and controls. And five of those six studies found higher mean uranium concentrations among cases compared to controls. 12 of our included studies looked at various types of cancer as their health outcome of interest. Of those, seven looked at cancer incidence. I should say one also looked at cancer case counts. And of the seven that looked at incidence, only two found higher incidence among their exposed populations compared to their unexposed populations. In contrast, in the cancer case control studies that again used or measured uranium concentration in human biological samples, all four found higher concentrations among cancer patients compared to healthy controls. I should say, though, that across our body of evidence, there was a very high risk of bias. Typically, studies didn't account for important confounders. They didn't account for other factors that could influence rates of cancer or birth defects. For example, with birth defect studies, a good study ought to account for maternal age, ought to account for consanguinity, which is the tendency to marry close relatives. It should count for maternal folate deficiency, and possibly it should account for exposures to other teratogens, like lead in leaded gasoline. So those were some of the elements that led to a high risk of bias across our body of evidence, but 81% of our included studies, 25 out of 31 across all outcomes, found an association between uranium exposure and adverse health outcomes. So that seems pretty condemning. The body of evidence was very consistent in the findings of direction of effect. Some of the strengths of our study was the sensitivity of our search strategy. Like I said, we captured more primary studies than any review article had before. And we didn't limit our search by language of publication. So hopefully, some of the studies that we found that were originally published in Arabic or only in the Iraqi Scientific Journal database, hopefully they get now wider readership and attention. But the TV didn't pick up that question, but you can ask it at the end. Going forward, more high-quality primary research on this topic is needed, such as a large-scale human observational study on the scale of the Iraqi Ministry of Health birth defect study or Les Roberts' mass mortality study in Iraq. Supplementing that research, the Iraqi Ministry of Health should release the full report from its 2011 study, and the U.S. Department of Defense should release a complete set of DU firing coordinates so that epidemiologists can have access to that data for their research. And even as research continues, I think there's enough evidence to justify a ban of depleted uranium weapons. Such a ban, modeled off of the treaty to ban landmines or the treaty to ban cluster munitions, has already been proposed. And not just proposed, but last year, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution that outlined a ban of uranium weapons. Even with progress like that, after 8 months of working on this systematic review, I was feeling pretty agitated about how unengaged academia can feel. I felt like, okay, I did some academic research, and now it's time to do some activism. And just as I was wrapping up my thesis, I found out about an Alaska Fellows Program position here in Juneau, working with Veterans for Peace, doing advocacy on nuclear issues. And so I applied for that, and that is what brought me back to Alaska from Beirut. And now, as I'm wrapping up my presentation, I have to give a plug for the project that Veterans for Peace and I am working on now, which is called Point Hope, Alaska's Youth Congress for the Global Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. This event will be held in Sitka from April 6th to 10th this spring, and up to 40 high school students will be accepted to attend. Our student application is open right now on our website, and it'll remain open until Friday, January 24th. If you'd like to learn more about the event or find out ways you can get involved, you can visit our website, which is akhopecongress.org. And I know that there are many Veterans for Peace members in the audience, but for those of you that aren't, there's a sign-up sheet right outside the door, and you can be added to Veterans for Peace's listserv, and there's some brochures about the project. So with that, thank you very much. And any questions?
That was Shelby Surdick on the dangers of depleted uranium, which, along with cluster bombs and other legacy lethal munitions banned by many countries around the world, are part of the current $1 billion military aid package the Biden administration is currently sending to Ukraine. And you've been listening to Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP, now broadcasting at 91.9 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care.
Depleted uranium is used on the ends of bullets and on the ends of shells because it's so hard. Almost any armament is vulnerable to something that's tipped with depleted uranium.
Yeah.
home and they produced a baby that was very severe malformations. Both the leukemia rates in children and malformations at birth had increased by 600%, and it was clearly an epidemic where all this DU had been dumped. It becomes a dust that can be inhaled and affect the bloodstream and the rest of the body. That was the opinion of the doctors there that this is caused by the planet uranium. They simply saw this as being a direct result of the war by the United States. Agent Orange, and I suspect that I'm worried that that's what will happen this time.
The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course, please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.
Makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Fired up. Hi, this is Holly Neer. I'm a singer and songwriter, and I've just gotten off the stage at ComFest here in Ohio 2012. I was here 37 years ago, so it was great to be back. I want to encourage you all to keep listening to community radio station, which you finally have, WCRS 102.1 and 98.3 FM. Listen to social change music and keep your hope alive.
You say cool down, we say step down, you're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global, unembedded, independent, investigative international news hour. You're listening to Columbus's only community radio station, WCRS 102.1 and 98.3 FM.